The Game Schooler Podcast is a weekly audio show that educates new and experienced gamers about the awesomeness of tabletop gaming. In this week's episode, we'll cover Abyss, our game of the week, discuss enjoying the hobby when you can't find a gamer in the school of gaming, and wrap it up by revealing our high five hidden gems from 2004 to 2014. Welcome to the Game Schooler Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Kotecki, along with my co-host, Dr. Michael McCabe. How's it going, Michael?
What's going on, Doug? Great, man. Happy to be here talking board games with my friend and just get caught up and find out what's new and different and wonderful with you.
Yeah, it's good. I'm excited. I've been having a downer with work, so I am pumped for this.
Doug, I bet you're not alone. I bet some of our listeners have had weeks like that, days like that, months like that.
So yeah, so let's
that's
talk
why they tune into a podcast where we talk about board games, right?
Yeah, let's talk about some fun stuff. I'm going to get some dirty housekeeping out of the way.
Get it.
With a thank you and some dirty housekeeping. But I want to thank you for all the likes, comments, and views on our YouTube videos for the podcast. It really means a lot, and I appreciate that because it does take time and effort to get those up there. So it's good when I can see the likes and things like that. So I appreciate that.
That's awesome.
That being said, I do have some more videos.
You want more? Is that what you want? You want more likes?
More.
that was good. That's a good start, people. But
if everybody could do a minimum of 5 likes,
get your
just
auntie
to get started.
And, Uncle Reiner.
Yeah, and if you could watch the video on different browsers in different locations, maybe, you know, 10 different things, tell your friends to watch so we can get those views up. No, what I was actually going to say is that I have some new videos that are going to be coming up, and I'm making a conscious decision to try and re-implement some of these, and I've done them in the past, but to add more overview videos, which to me are taking a little bit of what I do when we explain a game and just kind of have a brief overview of what the game is, how it looks on the table, kind of how you play it, and then some of the details. Usually they're under 2 minutes, around the 2.5 minutes. And I just think, and I make them because I personally would love to see more of them. With the amount of games that come out, it would be nice to have a place where I could just tell me a little bit about the game, give me the elevator pitch, show me how it looks on the table, and then I can decide whether I want to look at it further or maybe be exposed to a game quickly that I otherwise wouldn't have. So I'll be doing...
So I'm going to be... Allow me to be disingenuous guy for a moment here.
Yeah.
So how are they different from the 3,500 videos that Tom Bassel has made for the last 21 years on the Dice Tower? How are the overview videos that you are producing and making different from those videos?
They're 2 minutes long.
Yes.
So that is the big thing. The amount of time where I'm going to be starting with and doing essentially just the games of the week. You know, the games that we've talked about on the show. And I've got some oldies and new ones. And I don't know what order they're going to come out in necessarily. Hopefully going forward, because I'm doing the information gathering for the current games of the week, I'm hoping that those will kind of be the main ones going forward and then kind of pick up the ones that we've done from the past and kind of keep those going. But there's nothing worse than when I'm looking for information on a game and I say, the cover looks good, or the designer is somebody. And then I go online to YouTube or Board Game Geek or something like that, and all of the videos are 35 minutes long.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's a full playthrough. Like, I'm not that interested yet.
Yep.
I need to know what the game is like. And I think you and I have had some experiences of good and bad, whether we're at conventions where sometimes it's, yes, that is a perfect overview. You've taught me what I needed to. And other ones where it's like, all right, I kind of get it. We don't need to be here for 10 more minutes explaining that. So selfishly, I wish there were more videos like that out there, but I think it would be a great thing to add to what we're doing those videos will go up on the website as well. So then when people are looking at our database of games of the week, those videos will pop up there, and we'll have them on BoardGameGeek and stuff like that to help spread the word about the podcast. So that's some new stuff coming up. Is there anything else you need to follow up, things we talked about last week or anything like that?
No, I had a whole sketch in my mind mapped out where I would play the role of Uncle Reiner, and we would just improv. And on Saturday, I thought it was really funny, and I talked to Josie about it. And on Sunday, I just thought it could be a lawsuit, so I didn't even bother talking to you about it, or just, you know, do. I know that you've done improv in the past, and just say yes and go with it. But no, I got a haul of games from the good doctor that were delivered, and it's one of those things that I'm excited to play them. I got through The Desert and then Cascadero and Cascadito. They're actually right up behind me here.
Mm-mm, fancy.
But what that forced me to do was I need to play a handful of other games because I'm truly in a one-in, one-out mode for my collection, you know, not for reviewing games for the show, but if I'm going to keep something, I need to play something that's sitting on that big old shelf behind me over here. Great radio for those listening at home. So
just another reason to go watch the YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to see, but I thought I'm not going to do the Uncle Reiner voice. I don't want to get a lawsuit. And someday I do hope to meet him. You know, I man's got a dream. We did get, I'll just follow up on one thing. Episode 132 was, our game of the week was What the Cop. And last week we had talked about how, you know, we played that at Board Game Club.
Yeah.
And then my middle kiddo, who's attending Board Game Club because she has to, because her father helps to facilitate it, brought that upstairs and we played that as a family over the weekend.
Yeah.
And just, you know, a fun party game. Go back, listen to episode 132. When Doug does his 2-minute overview video of that, it'll be a full teach in 2 minutes. You could truly get that thing up and running while you are unboxing it. Great game from the team over at the op for our family. And one that I think we're going to take with us on the road. And when we just go to out and about this summer to different family events. So
yeah,
that was just one.
Did anybody stand up at the table and say, beat that, losers, when they won?
No,
but just my daughter.
That story did come up multiple times. Take that, losers.
Oh,
if we're
going to
use quotes, yeah, let's be accurate with the quotes. Take that, losers. So
I'm so proud.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what's awesome in gaming, Michael?
What's awesome with gaming? Where to start, Doug?
Yeah.
I'll send it back to you. Go ahead.
Well, what's awesome in gaming is reviewing another games on my shelf. We're back up to a Days of Wonder shelf, which has got some great games in it. And I actually love this shelf. The first one is Mystery Express, which is a game by maybe Serge Léger and Antoine Bauza, I know for sure, is one of the designers. But it's a Clue-style deduction game in which you are on a train, but you know, there's none of the roll and move type of stuff. You just pick which room that you want to go to. And each room has a different ability for how you're getting information from one another. But the cool thing is that unlike Clue, where you're just trying to find which card is missing, there are three of every card. And you're trying to find which one is missing. So you're only looking for two out of the three. It's like, oh, I've seen. And so there are ways that other people are giving clues and passing cards to one another. And you're thinking, did I see this one again? Or is that a new one? And trying to figure that out. I'm a sucker for deduction games, but I have a hard time getting those to the table, which is unfortunate. The next one we just talked about recently, which is Cargo Noir. So go back in the archives and listen to our Game of the Week segment on that, which is a auction game in which you're collecting illicit goods and trying to sell them on the black market. The next game is Colosseum, which we've talked about in a couple of high five lists as the original was better than a reprint and that there is a new version coming out. But in Colosseum, you are collecting performers and set pieces and things like that to put on various productions. and try and do the highest score. And it works similar to the way that First in Flight does, where whatever your highest score is, that's where you stay. And if you do another production and it's not higher than your previous one, you just stay where you are on the score track. The next one is Memoir 44, which is a really cool two-player game. One we should probably look at maybe talking about in the School of Gaming segment at some point. But just a really cool World War II game that has a lot of history behind the scenarios and how things are set up in kind of a reduced
mini war game.
It's a mini war game without all the complexity and without all of the violence or anything like that. So it's not a horrific World War II game. And then the last one is Ticket to Ride Asia, which is a Ticket to Ride map pack that has what are on the sides? I know that one of them is a team game, is one of the maps. So, and I think the other one has some hills that are difficult to get through. So that is what is on my shelf in that section. So hopefully awesome, people are enjoying that. I enjoy talking about games that we don't often get to talk about on the air. So that's what I've got.
No, that's great.
How about you?
Mystery Express is one of those that I haven't played. That's been on my want to play list for a long time. So
does your wife like deduction games?
Yeah, deduction. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And I've been on a Serge Leggett kick recently, you know, going through Nidavellir and a few others of his. I've been on the search for Cargo Noir now for a little bit, and I'll probably pick that up at the Gen Con flea market.
How many people
do you need for that one? I know it's a three-player minimum, but is that a best at five or best at four?
No, I've played it on all different player counts, and I haven't noticed anything where it's like, ooh, I'm just not getting the same, because there's the same amount of cards. They're just distributed differently based on the number of players.
Interesting. That's a good shelf. No, I like that segment. I'm looking forward to watching that continue. Now, Doug, this means you won't be able to redo your Calyxes, though, for what, the next...
Forever.
47 more? Is that what you have left?
Yeah. Just, meh. They can change all the way up until... I just can't take any of the five out that we've done. Those need to stay there. Anything we haven't discussed... we're fine fluctuating until we get there, but if we've talked about it, it can't move for
a year.
And then
our listeners want to know, how many more Days of Wonder shelves are there in this series?
Two, maybe, which is not bad.
At least two.
That's not bad. It's like eight games.
No, it's like your shelf, man. It's your collection. Games. It's great. I'm just giving you a hard time. It's just banter.
You got a full Reiner Calyx? Getting there.
It's getting there, man. Phil Walker Harding got bumped out a little bit.
Uh-oh.
I felt bad for Phil. And I've got these, this is bad moments in podcasting, radio. My communications professor would be driving off the road right now. But I have those shelves.
The in-between shelves?
Oh, man. Yeah,
the
I think it's
that
Cloud
divide,
Puncher.
That divide
yeah,
the calyx.
So you can... stack them. No, not those. I have those as well.
Oh, okay.
But I have these little wooden pegs that you put in so that you can, you know, pull the game right out the shelf.
Oh, gotcha.
And all that to say, I won't be able to push Phil Walker Harding out too far because I have them measured for him. So at some point in time, Phil and Reiner are going to have a war. It'll be
a battle.
Minister Walker Harding against Dr. Reiner Knizia, and we'll see who comes out of that one.
That would be a good March Madness thing to have a whole Reiner bracket
on
one side and
don't
a full Phil Walker Harding on the other side, and they'll battle it out until a Reiner game and a Phil Walker Harding game meet in the middle for the championship.
There you go. Don't make me
supremacy.
Do the voting.
Okay.
Well, it'd have to go over quality then, not quantity. So.
Yes. Well, yeah, that shouldn't be hard.
Oh, hey, easy now. Be good to the good doctor. What else do you have, Doug?
Nothing. I know that we've been pushing off some games that you played that you want to talk about.
Yeah, I could do that now. I've got a whole slew of them, and I know these didn't make your list of games that are running into your collection. So all that I ask, just share honestly. You know what I mean? We don't need to go easy on. No, you can. Let's be real. If we're going to talk about it,
it's garbage.
Which one did you want me to talk about? Wandering Towers or Forest Shuffle?
We talked about Forest Shuffle.
All right, good. Yeah. Then we'll go with Wandering Towers. A couple weeks ago, we had a friend over, and I'd gotten this one in a trade at Capstone Games. Brought the game to the United States. It was released, I think, in 2022 now. It's a Kiesling and Kramer game where there's just a zaniness about it. You're trying to get your wizards out and get them back into this tower. You can... You get three cards in your hand. You play one card at a time out of your hand, and you're either moving the wizards or moving the tower. And these towers stack on top of each other, almost like if you think of the Yahtzee cup turned upside down. And if you were able to stack a Yahtzee cup on top of other Yahtzee cups, that's not nearly the quality, but it gives you the gist of what you're doing in the game. And every time you cover up a wizard with your Yahtzee cup, with your tower, you flip over a potion. And the win condition, you got to get all of your wizards back into this big old tower and have all of your potions flipped over. I had a blast playing it. There was just something too. I could do a little bit of something on my turn, but didn't quite know what it was going to be until it was my turn. And there was absolutely no forward planning, but it was one of those where I thought I was able to figure out one cool thing to do, and I like that in a lot of the Kramer and Kiesling games. Sometimes it drives me nuts that I want to do three cool things, but I can only do one cool thing with the four limited options that they've provided. But it's one that sits firmly in my collection here, looking forward to playing with the family. I thought about bringing it to Board Game Club, but it's just a little too... maybe I'm going to say futsy for the setup in that hour, and I don't trust other people's kids with it.
Yeah.
Just because it's a game that I got in a trade that I hope to keep in my house for several years. But that was my take on it.
Yeah. I've wrestled with this one for a while because there are some things that I don't like. We played it twice, right?
Yeah, we did run it back twice.
Except the first time we got a slight rule wrong. And I don't know if it was turn order or what, but I just felt like I was getting clobbered the entire game. And there was nothing I could do about it. I'm always trying to wrestle, like, make sure that it's not because I lost, you know, which it wasn't that, or to blame it on like, oh, well, I went last in turn order and the game is biased towards that. That's not the case either. What I think it came down to me was I don't mind a fun game without a lot of control and that chaos, but I don't like when games have that, but then give you elements that give you a perception of control. So Impact would be a good example of a game where it's like, it's fun, or even What the Cup. There's a lot of chaos and randomness going on in a game like that, but I'm going into it expecting that. And maybe I went into Wandering Towers with the wrong approach of thinking that it wasn't one of those games, but I felt like the cards that you got made me feel like, oh, well, I can manipulate stuff, but then when I don't have the cards to manipulate it in a way that I want to, I feel like the game is just happening to me. So it didn't work out well for me, but I can't quite figure out why, or assuming it's a me problem, because it's very much a loved and well-regarded game.
Now, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, and I'm not going to try to talk you out of your own reflection here, but I think... All right, now I'll speak for me, because we've been playing a lot of games over the last 6 months. And more than once, I'll get into a game and I just don't enjoy what I'm actually doing in the game as much as other people at the table do.
Yeah.
And I'll look around and be like, man, Doug and his daughter are having a blast. Well, I need to have fun here too. And yeah. I'm trying, but just, and I don't know if that was what happened to you in the play of Wandering Towers, but I know more than once when we have played a game multiple times and it comes up for review, it's just, no, it wasn't the fact that I got doubled up by your oldest child. It was just, I didn't really enjoy what I was doing in the game. That I love what you said there about that sense of perceived control. I struggle when games have a undefined timer. And I don't know when it's going to end. And there are times where I love that, and there are other times where it drives me nuts and I want to flip the table. So it was interesting to just hear that one didn't work out for you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's great, how it goes.
Great production. The other thing too is I read the rules and I had a really hard time understanding.
Rules are garbage, man. they really are.
Until we got it up and going, you know.
It's clear that Capstone doesn't send us review copies and I got to pay full price when I want it. But no, the rules, there's more than one thing lost in translation in that. And my oldest, not to go off on a Wandering Towers tangent, because I love the game. I absolutely love the game. But it's one of those where if you get that game, there are videos out there that do a better job.
Yeah.
Very rarely will I send someone to a video instead of sending them to the rule book, especially people who play a lot of games. But there's just some double negatives back to back in there about what the wizard will not do except when they will do. And it's like, wait, what? So
I'm interested to see when you play this with your family, what the consensus is there. Because I can equally see some of your family loving it, and I can equally see some of them being like completely bored that it's just not working for them. So I'm curious to see where that falls when it gets introduced to them.
Well, I'll report back to you.
All right. Sounds good. It's a date. some housekeeping. According to the Discord server, it's been about 1 year since the Discord server has been live. So congratulations to that. Appreciation to Michael and Stefan for setting that up for us. So I appreciate that.
Oh, it was all Stefan, man.
If you are interested, you can sign up by going to gameschooler.com/discord, and it'll tell you everything you need to know to sign up and get involved in this awesome community that we have. If you like what we're doing, spread the word about the podcast. We really appreciate that. And if you have questions or comments, reach out to us, email@gameschooler.com. Now, let's move on to the game of the week.
The game of the week. The game of the week is an in-depth look at a family-friendly game we think you should try if you get the chance. This week's game is Abyss. Doug, give us the stats.
All right. Published in 2014, not hidden enough to be part of our high five list later. The publisher is Bombix, and the designers are Bruno Catala and Charles Chevalier. The art is by Xavier Collette. 2 to 4 players, about 30 to 60 minutes. That's going to be dependent on player count. The box says 14 plus. Board Game Geek says 10 plus, which I think is crazy. I think this is a solid 12 plus and lands in a light hobby game. You on board with that, Michael?
Agreed. Agreed with all of that.
All right. Abyss is a game of development, combination, and collection in which players try to take control of strategic locations in an underwater city. To achieve this, players must develop on 3 levels, first by collecting allies, then using them to recruit lords of the Abyss, who will then grant access to different parts of the city. Players acquire cards through a draft of sorts, and the lords of the Abyss are acquired the Lords of the Abyss acquired grant special powers to the card holder. But once you use the card to acquire a location, that power is shut off. So players need to time their land grabs well in order to put themselves in the best position of when the game ends. There are 3 things that you do on your turn. You can search the depths. When you search the depths or explore the depths, you are flipping over cards one at a time from a deck of ally cards. These are cards in five different colors that are numbered between 1 and 5 on the cards. And you flip over a card. The tricky thing with this game is that when you flip it over, it is your turn. You are the active player. You need to offer every card that you flip over to your opponents first. So if they would like to buy that before you get it, they can give you a pearl and buy that card. Once one player has done that, if another player wants to buy another card in the row from you, they will pay you 2 pearls and so on until it would max out at 3 pearls with 4 players. But you keep going. Eventually, if you find a card that you want, you will take it into your hand. Or you keep filling it up until you get all the way to the end and you have to take that card. Plus, you get a pearl for your troubles. But all of the other cards that you haven't taken get turned face down and placed onto the board in their respective color categories.
Real quick. Tell our listeners that are dying, what are pearls? Or are you going to get there later?
Yeah, pearls are essentially a part of a currency. There are ways to manipulate what you can do, whether that's buying cards or using it as a wild. There's some different benefits for pearls, but essentially it's a currency. While you're flipping over cards, there is a possibility that a sea monster card will come up. If that happens, you then have the choice to either collect the reward for the sea monster or move the sea monster up in its reward track and keep going. So eventually that could keep getting more powerful and more powerful until somebody finally takes it. And that's going to give you pearls and points and things like that. Also on your turn, instead of drawing cards, exploring the depths, you can take one of those face down stacks of cards from the middle of those ally cards. And so that would be your whole turn. And so there's a little bit of a memory or kind of keeping track of what cards may have gone in there, especially as people are pushing their luck while they're exploring the depths and pushing past cards, hoping to get a better one or a specific color card. The third thing that you can do on your turn is recruit the lords, which are cards along the bottom of the game board that have special abilities, and they have a cost. Usually it's it might say 1 or 2 different colors, maybe 3, but one of them has to be red or has to be one of these colors. And the total of the cards, the total sum of the numbers on the cards need to be equal to or greater than the value of the Lord. There's no change.
There's basically a set criteria that you must fulfill in order for you to pull one of those Lords.
Yeah, and there's no change given. So you want to try and be as exact as possible. But the other interesting thing is, out of the lowest value card that you use to play or to pay for that Lord, you get to set one of those aside for the end game scoring, and that's going to give you points at the end of the game. So you're kind of doing this struggle of, I want that Lord, but I also want to use high cards to pay for it so I can get a high value card that's going to stick around for the end of the game. As the description said, each of the lords has a special ability of some kind. Along with it, it may have key symbols on the side of it. And if it has key symbols, the moment which you collect your third key symbol, you have to take a location card. And those keys are then tied to that location, and it covers up their ability, which you can no longer use. The location boards give you endgame scoring. And there's a real cool mechanism in which there are 1 or 2 that are face out in the beginning of the game. And you can choose, when it's time for you to take a location, I can choose to look at more of them. However, once I do that, now those, for example, would be now available for Michael, and he doesn't have to spend anything extra to go looking for those. The game ends when a certain number of lords are attained. I think it might be 6 or 7. And then whoever has the most points based on their location boards, their lords, tokens they've collected throughout the game is what, and then those leftover ally cards that you were able to save from purchasing lords are what add up to total your points, and whoever has the most points wins. That is how you play Abyss. Michael, what do you like about this game?
Well, I love the flow of the game. I talked about it a little bit. When we played Cargo Noir and reviewed that just a few episodes ago, the actual turn structure of flipping over a card and I'm offering it to everybody, there's a moment of terror, hesitation, bluffing that I love bluffing in games. And I know you know that, but if our listeners are new to us, I just love being able to keep a poker face for all of 3.5 seconds. Then, yes, I got the card. Oh, you guys can't wait to see what I got. But then there's also that sense of there's enough things happening, enough good decisions. And sometimes it's that second and third order decision. I don't talk about this a whole lot on the podcast, but I do coach high school basketball. And one thing that I love in high school basketball is setting up a play, right? So, oh, we're going to show you a back screen. We're going to show you a back screen. Oh, never mind. Now we're coming with the alley-oop, throwing it above the rim. And very few games that are played in under 2 hours really have that level of setup. And I like that. Working towards getting those lords in. And then the last thing, just to say before sending it back to you, is figuring out how I'm going to score points once I trade in cards to get the lords. Am I calling them by the right thing? They're called lords, right? The special baddies that you get. So there's a lot of moving parts. For a long time, the only thing I knew about this game was it had one of the coolest covers of any game that I'd ever seen. Didn't know a lot about it. And so I was really glad when we got to the table and got it played and then replayed and got after it a little bit. Been playing it on Board Game Arena. I know I said I was going to send it back to you, but the last thing I'll say, this is a game, folks, don't play this asynchronously over Board Game Arena. Just my opinion. This is one, play it in one sitting. Have a good time with it. Because very, very different
Too hard to
virtual
keep track of.
perception. Oh man, you telling me I'm getting smoked over and over. It just pops at the table though, how the art and everything fits. How about you?
Well, you mentioned one of the things, which is the artwork is amazing in this game. It was one of the, when it first was released, it was one of the first games, I think, that had four different covers for this game. It's now standardized into one, but you could get four different covers when it came out. I think what I really like about this game is it does a lot of stuff. It combines a lot of stuff that is not combined in other games or different mechanisms that you don't see very often. And like the way that you're acquiring those ally cards that push your luck river of putting them out and that you have to offer them to other opponents first. Like, I've not seen that in another game. And then even the idea of like, okay, you work your way up and it's like, yes, I got one really high card out of that. But then at the same time, if people keep pushing it to the end, eventually there's a big stack to take. And it's like, yeah, it may have a lot of ones of twos, but those can help you pay for things. And that's a rewarding turn as well of just like, I've got four more cards now. And even to the idea of like, I know there are other games that have the idea of a card with a special ability that the power then gets turned off. Like, that's in other games, but I really like it in this game because
Yeah,
there
and
are
it's not mean. It's as a defense, right?
sometimes, yeah. It's di it's different. It works in different ways, and there are things where it's like, I really want that Lord, but I don't want the third key. So what do I do? Because if I take it and it's the third key, I don't even get to use the ability depending on what it is. And so trying to balance out that timing of it, it is, there are some, this is one of the caveats that I have to be aware of, is that there are some mean cards in the game, but there are also cards that counter those as well. But it can be
And
frustrating.
it's obvious. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well,
Go ahead.
it can be frustrating when it's like, oh, there's a card in there that makes buying other lords more expensive. But eventually that card will get covered up. Those cards, if your opponent wants to win, they'll eventually cover it up. because they need the points from locations. At the same time, there are other cards in the game that will counteract those as well. So it's one of those that the first time through, it could be rough if those hit you the wrong way. But if you play it again or you see those counter cards come out, you get to see how you can mitigate that a little bit.
Yeah, and I know we have some listeners that have shared with us and shared in the Discord and email that, you know, we talk about a game, they stumble across it at their local thrift store or whatever magical place their board games appear, and they take it home and teach it. That was the only thing that I had in my notes, is make that abundantly clear in the initial teach of just, Doug, there was a card that basically mitigated against all military cards. Yeah. Right. And you pointed that out when you taught the game to me the first time. So it's like, ooh, I'm going to go ahead and get that card. Now, for the first 30% of the game, I don't have to worry about getting attacked.
Yeah.
And it was just one thing that I could kind of, you know, offload and think, okay, that's not going to happen in my initial game of Abyss. I can move on to other parts of the game. And
yeah.
We talked in the School of Gaming last week about making things an enjoyable experience. Anytime there's Take That, I think you just want to point it out to people, especially if you're playing with children, other people's children. It's a good teaching point. But I didn't think it was to the point where it could possibly ruin the experience, because there were so many different possibilities within the game. It's not like you're just refined to those one or two characters. I mean, even in a two-player game, you're choosing from how many different possibilities.
Yeah, and the more players you have, the more it's unlikely that one player, for example, is going to get all of those and kind of beat up on everybody else. Those things are kind of going to
can't buy them all.
Are going to get spread out. I love the idea of when you're paying for the lords, it's not just accumulating as fast as you can to just buy it and spend it. You need to keep an eye on what you're using to buy the Lord, because of those endgame victory points by which ones you're able to set aside. So it's not just hurry up and spam a whole bunch of resources and now I can buy this
Lord. That's a good point.
There's another level on top of it that I'm holding a hand, and it's like, yeah, I could buy this right now, but do I want to buy it with the cards that I have? Or is there one more out there, that like another ally out there that I might be able to get that can make this an awesome turn?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that takes me into the last thing that I just want to mention that I really like. Board Game Geek does not have a classification for multiple currencies.
Mm.
But there's something about this game where, you know, in a lot of Euro games, you'll have different tracks and you're just trying to push the levers to get to move up on the different tracks and optimize as many of the tracks as possible. In Abyss, there are all these different currencies that work together. You have the currency of the pearls. You have the currency of the sets and getting them to meet certain conditions. You want to be able to, you know, work at different locations. And I like how all those pieces work together. And I think especially when we're playing games and thinking about, you know, telling the story of a game for a podcast, that's something for me that always jumps a game up my list, because it's, ooh, this has the potential, you know, not that I'm ever going to sit down, play Abyss with my family and say, oh, you're going to do some personal financial literacy takeaways after you play this game.
Yeah.
But in my mind, there's that potential. I know it makes no sense, but just how all those different facets work together. And I mentioned earlier a few episodes ago about Nidavellir, the Serge Legette game, where you're going into taverns and you're recruiting army people and you're upgrading your currencies, and very similar piece where there's just all these different little facets that work together to have like, oh, there are multiple currencies in this game that all work together well.
Yeah, I do have in my notes that it's like, I like the pearls with the idea as not only as a component, you know, they're the fake plastic pearls that you would find on a necklace type of thing, but also as a mechanism of, to your point, it's an alternative currency, but it's also like, it's almost like a little tip or an extra nudge. It's like, oh, I can just buy that. I can reveal some more cards. I can spend them in ways that are more of a manipulative or tipping the scales type of thing. It's like, I feel like a gangster of like, yes, I will be sitting in that table by the window type of thing. Here's the extra money in my palm is kind of how the pearls feel to me. And I like that. I like, and to your point, not only are you managing the pearls, you're managing your allies and you're managing those keys, even though it's only three of them. Figuring out when you want that third one or how you're going to do that is a very interesting aspect of the game. And
yeah, because there's a race there too, right?
If
I want to get that location before other people at the table do, I need to get that third key.
I think there's six different types of lords that all kind of specialize in one area of the game or another. So some of them help you get more pearls. Some of them are just straight bigger victory points. There's military ones that give you more of that kind of cutthroat type of stuff. So there's a lot of flexibility in this game.
Yeah. Now, it was re-implemented in 2019. Do you know anything about that version? Have you come across it? Have you seen it?
Sometimes this happens on Board Game Geek where they say re-implemented, and I think it would be a better thing of like reimagined, or it's in the same universe, but it's not necessarily the same game streamlined or changed like that. So I think it's just a card game at that point. But
okay, so it's a different game then. Okay,
it's a different game. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Let's see. What else do we have? I think those are. I think it is another thing to note as far as we talked about that there are some meanness parts, but it can seem frustrating when the opponents take great cards on your draw, even though you're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Sometimes that can be frustrating. Which is part of the game. I mean, that's
especially
one of those
great cards.
Yeah. You know, if a five gets turned over and then it's the one that you're looking for, and then your opponent swoops in and buys it. But to me, it falls under the category of what we talked about a little while ago. Is like, it's a good pain point. It's not one of those that's like, it's just part of the game to be aware of before you go in there, especially if you're playing with younger kids. That would be something that my kids potentially would be like, that was the one I wanted. And then they would be devastated. And it's like, no, you'll be fine type of thing.
You've got to have a little bit of resilience.
Yeah, exactly. And I have that as one of my skills this week. How about you?
Yeah, I have resilience and comprehension were the two that I have. I didn't think about what you had just said with somebody taking an awesome card on your turn. Mm. My thing was getting beat by just one turn to the location that you want.
Sure.
I think multiple players can be going after the same location, and I might be prepared like on this next turn. You know, that thing that I talked about at the opening of the segment about the setup, that setup turn that makes everything so much fun. It's like, all right, I'm getting ready. I'm going to go get that location. I'm going to go get, whoa, Doug just bought that location and I was going to do that on my next turn. And you just have to be a little bit resilient, a little bit tactical, and jump right back in. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I have resilience. I think that's a good skill. I think the risk management of when to kind of push your luck and take a stack, or, you know, you're being too greedy, trying to get a great card instead of settling for a good card. And then you're loading up those ally stacks for your opponent. I think that's important. I think it's also important to notice a big part of the game is when it's not your turn and somebody else is drawing, is kind of that observation and knowing what cards are going face down and kind of keeping track of that, keeping track of what types of what color cards your opponents are collecting to know what kind of lords they might be going after, which ones they can afford, things like that that are happening throughout the game. I think observation is a really strong skill. And again, we talk about observation a lot. And sometimes there are things where a game becomes so intense that you can't even focus on anybody else's, you know, what anybody else is doing. It's like, I have enough worrying about my own stuff. This one is one of those that allows you to look around the table and see what's happening, and paying attention on other people's turns not only because you might get a chance to buy a card on their turn, but to see what's getting flipped over and what's face down and that type of stuff. So there's some pretty cool skills in this game. I think it's going to fit best on a similar to last week's game with a game night or a family that has gaming experience for sure.
Yeah, I would say run it back. If you're the gamer in the group and you've played it with, and this is true, I think, for a lot of light hobby games, but that first time you play it, really take the time to let other people get the rules down. And then, man, if it is a game night, if it is a weekend and you can play it for that second time back to back, I think people get, at least I know I did. I got so much more out of the game the second play.
Sure.
That would be my only suggestion, but it fits really well at a weekend or a game night.
Yep, I agree. So that is our game of the week, Abyss from 2014 in Bombix. Give it a try if you get the chance. Let's move on to the School of Gaming.
The School of Gaming. In the School of Gaming, we discuss concepts, keywords, etiquette, and helpful ideas in the world of gaming. This week, we're going to discuss enjoying the hobby when you cannot find another gamer to game with.
Yeah, and excluding solo games. So that was the specific caveat of, how do I enjoy this hobby when I don't have other people to play and I either don't want to or don't have the time or can't play solo? Which is an interesting question, and it's probably something that I run into maybe more than you do, because you do play more solo games. And so I can only speak to, I guess, kind of what I do. I have one at the end that is kind of more ubiquitous and different. But one of the things that I found when I'm kind of have the itch to game, but nobody's around, my kids aren't around or things like that, is I feel like just reading rules and looking at the components and kind of just sitting with, sounds terrible, but like sitting with my game.
No, figuring out the game.
Which could turn into a sad meme of somebody sitting alone at a table with their game. But just kind of being around the world, whether that's, you know, around my collection or pulling boxes off the shelf and looking at them, either reading rules to something I haven't played in a long time, something I'm going to be playing, something I just played, kind of gives me the feeling of being in the hobby without necessarily interacting at a game.
Yeah, that's in our house, we call that, or I call that, researching a game.
Sure.
So I'll say, hey, I'm going to research this game for a little bit, and I'll even put a timer on it. You know, for the next half hour, I'm going to go through the rule book and just see the setup, get the pieces out, get familiar with the components. But then everyone else in the house knows I'm not committing the next 4 hours of my life to this game either. I'm just checking it out to see if it's worth that. This is a challenge, and this is a significant, it's a challenge, a barrier for me. Because at the same time, I mean, you have friends and you have a game group, and there's overlap with friends in a game group oftentimes, at least there's for me. And I don't necessarily want to just push games onto people as well. So sometimes it's not just when you cannot find another gamer, but sometimes it's, man, how much of this do I want to push with the two gamers that I'm always playing with?
Yeah.
Isolation is real. And, you know, I think, and I haven't lived in a big city in a long time. But I live in a small rural community now. And at the same time, as I'm thinking, there are communities that are a lot smaller and a lot more rural than where we live.
Yeah.
And my biggest, I would say, antipode for the cannot find another gamer is the convention is, conventions are huge. I mean, if you can get to a convention and play 12 to 15 games in a weekend, and I know that's also not possible for everybody.
Well,
you know, conventions cost money and conventions cost time, but
I mean, I think and maybe you took this differently, but I was operating under the idea of like the assumption that is already there. It's been decided that there are no other gamers. Like,
yeah,
I'm not going to a convention. I'm not doing anything else. It is determined that I am stuck here. Now, what do I do? Now, how do I enjoy the hobby type of thing? Because certainly conventions are great. I mean, the one thing too is like Board Game Arena is an awesome outlet for there's nobody physically here and you can play online and you don't necessarily have to play solo in there. But what do I do when I know it's a night, it's a Wednesday night and I don't have anything going on? I want to do something with the hobby, but nobody's around, right? One of the things I thought about was, or that I have enjoyed, and it's not something I do all the time, but every once in a while, I do enjoy watching others play games online, like playthrough videos or something, especially when, you know, Dice Tower does some of their marathons or things like that, where it's like maybe games I've heard of or I haven't seen, or I have it but haven't played it yet. And it just gives me a little bit of a feeling of like, living vicariously through somebody else without having to, I didn't have to set it up. I don't have to worry about the rules. I can just kind of sit there and enjoy it. And I don't have to be awkwardly sitting there at a convention next to somebody else's table. Mind if I sit in and watch for a second? Like I said, it's not something I do all the time.
You can awkwardly do it in the comforts of your own house, huh?
Yeah, exactly. don't mind if I sit and judge and watch you play games. So I
wonder if that will be more of a thing, you know, as the World Series of Board Games and other board gaming events are really pushed. I wonder if that part of the hobby will grow.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, it's
the
interesting.
The watching of games. Because there are, we've talked a lot about the glut of games and games that come and go, but then there are games that stay and stick and that play great with four, but I certainly don't have three other people here to play. So what am I going to do? Yeah, that's interesting.
The other thing I like to do is, and you mentioned it, you called it like the research aspect, but just the idea of like going online and whether it's Board Game Geek or watching videos of like reviews and things like that of learning about new games, like what other games are out there. And I don't think that's unique to us having a podcast either. I was doing it long before I had a podcast of what's out there or, ooh, I heard some people, you know, I had friends talking about this other game. I'm going to dig into it a little bit more. What's coming out at Origins, all that type of stuff. That's like, those are activities that make me feel connected to the hobby that are not just playing games. You're being around it.
Yeah, and this is adjacent to what you're saying, and I'm not proud to say it. I'm going to come off as the weirdo now, so a little bit of latitude here. But I know in the past, and not too distant past, like last few days, I'll get on Noble Knight, and I'll just kind of troll around and look for a happy surprise. So, whoa. Why is this Steffenfeld game from 2011 $225? What is the story here? And then I'll bounce into Board Game Geek and I'll jump into the forums and I'll look and find out why, you know, a game is and just finding out the story of a game.
That's
also sometimes not the hands-on research, but just, you know, sitting on a couch with an iPad or a telephone research of being curious about the hobby. I'll be honest though, it doesn't solve that sense of wanting to play. For me, the only thing that really does is to get a game out and look at it and look at the clock and kind of do a check-in with my family of, am I okay to nerd out at the kitchen table right now with this game? And then put it away, you know, 45 minutes or an hour later. And then I feel like I'm a little bit closer for the next time. Right, the next time the game group gets together, I'm a little more prepared to play. I don't know if this is being helpful at all.
Well, it's just different thing. I mean, you know, you mentioned just going on the Noble Knight thing, just going to store, like local game stores that sometimes if I'm, you know, I drop my daughter off at dance or something like that and I got 15 minutes, it's like,
yeah,
I'll go to the local game store, and I have no intention, and it's harder for some people to do than others, but I go in with no intention of buying anything, and I walk out with nothing.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's nice to just look at games in the box and get a scale for how big is this box? How big is this game? There's been times where I've gone in and I've seen something, I'm like, holy moly, this thing is humongous. Or yeah, the exact opposite.
Actually,
it's like,
had that happen.
What is this, in an Altoids box? This is false representation. Like, so just some of those things are like, oh, this art looks better in person. Or, you know, you never know when you're going to find a game that's like, oh man, I've been looking for that. Sometimes you never know in a board game store what is going to be something that's sitting on the shelf forever for one store, and another store would love to have that because it would be gone immediately.
Yeah.
And the amount of times I've walked into a store, it's like, how do they still have this? And you're like, is this a joke? Is there something wrong with this? I need to buy this immediately. So just kind of that browsing. And like I said, not necessarily, I go in without, like, I don't need to spend money. Like, I'm not one of those people that if I go into a board game store, I have to leave with something, or I'm going to get sucked in. And I know that's
Doug,
not
I
the
believe
case
it was the
everybody.
Third day of Gen Con before you spend money. So I can confirm you're very, very prudent in the board game sphere.
Yeah, and not on a cheap level. Not afraid to spend money, but I'm looking for the right thing.
Yeah, I do want to just touch on, though, that this can be a challenge.
I mean,
it is the hobby in all its various branches of the family tree, or all of the different people that make up the hobby under the circus tent of the hobby. Most of it requires other people at some point.
Yeah,
you know?
I think you're onto something where it's like there are two aspects of okay, I don't have anybody, now what? It's a stopgap, but ultimately, if you want to continue to enjoy the hobby, eventually you're going to have to find other players. So,
yeah.
And you're going to have to play games. Now, whether they're, you know, that's, you've got a weekly game group, or you don't, or, you know, go to conventions, or all the things that we've talked about of ways that you can go out and find other gamers, which could be its own separate topic. I do feel like you're right on the ball that if you don't have consistent gaming time with other folks, you're not going to be enjoying the hobby for very long because of how interactive and social the hobby is just in general, right?
Well, that's definitely a possibility, but I agree with you. It's just that for some people, that's their reality, especially if people work on the road, you know, and maybe they don't have that consistent spot. And that's where that old Abraham Lincoln quote, or the quote that's attributed to Abraham Lincoln, although I can never find out where he actually said it, but prepare and my time will come. Right. And I've got a handful of games behind me that I haven't played with any people.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to teach them because I've opened them up and gone through them. Sometimes, like this one right here, right there, I've opened that thing up like four different times. But no one in my family, like, Dad, we're good on Reiner. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to go through it all right now. I'm going to be ready so that when somebody wants to play it, I'm ready. I don't know if that's a helpful stance. I do think that this is a challenge, though.
I think it comes, like I said, I think it could be its own episode of, if you aren't consistently gaming, how can you either become more consistent or find more ways to game? It's almost two different sides, right?
And yeah, it is.
Of that same coin. The other thing I've got, the last thing I've got, is kind of goes without saying if you've been listening to the podcast for any amount of time, but painting miniatures or painting the components in the game is a way for me to enjoy and experience a game without necessarily playing it, too. Is another one of those. We've talked a lot about all the adjacent kind of side hobbies and things that you can do, whether you're, if you want to make your own inserts, there's
or company. Fold them from fold
or fold them. Fold yeah. an
insert. That's how I feel like I'm contributing. Oh, I'm folding this pre-made insert that was made by brilliant engineers.
Getting player aids, even like I don't do it often, but sleeving cards and things like that, where you're setting up the game or putting it in baggies and getting it ready for the. I guess I'm more prone to set it up so it's easy to set up when I need to play it next, and figuring out those solutions of what needs to be in what bag or how the insert should be laid out so I can get it going as fast as possible is another thing that you can do that gives me the feeling of playing a game in some regards, or at least enjoying the hobby, right? It's not necessarily about playing the games when you don't have other people. It's how can you enjoy and still be invested in the hobby, and those are some of the things that I do. Anything else, Michael?
No, I think we covered a lot.
All right. Well, let us know on the Discord if there's anything that we missed or things that you guys do in the downtime of the hobby that you enjoy and appreciate
and people
as
will.
Well. Yeah.
People will. That's why when we do a School of Gaming episode like this, I love running into our Discord a day or so after the episode airs and finding out what others do, because I'm learning, you know?
Yeah. So we appreciate and keep that coming. Let's move on to the high five. If you're anything like us, you're constantly on the hunt for new games to try out. This week, Michael and I are going to be talking about hidden gems from a decade, 2 decades ago, 2004 to 2014.
20 years ago.
What's that?
Yeah, 20 years ago. 20 years ago.
Yeah. Did you change that? Was it originally 2011 to 2014? Or did I just copy it down wrong?
No, I think it was. I did not change that.
Okay.
No. When you said it, that's what was coming up last week, I was like, I wouldn't have written that. No, 10 to 20 years ago.
Okay.
Because then my thought is, you know, a year from now, we can roll that forward.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, always looking for new ways to have repeatable content. I like it, Michael.
There it is.
The only thing that I kind of... So my games are ranked in the order of... My number one is the lowest rated game in Board Game Geek overall rating from those years in my collection.
Okay, and I have some caveats. Mine, one, I could not have put it in a top 10 list in the last 6 months.
Okay.
And two, it does not currently sit in the Board Game Geek top 1,000. And for 4 out of 5 games, they've never been a game of the week. There's one that I was like, I got to talk about this game. So those are my caveats. Yep, should we jump in?
Yeah, none of mine have been game of the week. And very few of these have been talked about. And if they have, it's been a while probably.
Awesome.
So go ahead.
Number 5 for me is what the renowned artist Bob Ross would refer to as a happy accident. Number 5 is designed by Ben Pinchback and Matt Riddle. It is Fleet 2012. Mm-hmm. And in Fleet, and notice, I didn't say Fleet the dice game. Our friends over at the Family Gamers, Andrew and Anitra, especially Andrew, loves Fleet the dice game. So I had it on a wanted trade list, and I was really excited to get Fleet, except I got the original from 2012, the Eagle Griffin game, Fleet. And Doug, I got to tell you, I still haven't played Fleet the dice game, but Fleet is a ton of fun. You have these cards. Are you familiar with it?
Roughly. I'm looking at it right now.
All right. You have these cards that serve multiple purposes. One, you've got to be able to acquire specific fishing licenses. So for specific types of fish. And then you've got to be able to get the boats to go get those fish. And then you have to have a captain to drive the boat. And it was one of those where truly I was disappointed when I got this game in a trade. I thought, Michael, you fool. You have a darn board game podcast. How could you get the wrong game? And then I got it, and I looked it up on Board Game Arena, and it was there. The tutorial was brilliant. Very, very easy to learn and play. And it's just, it's a small box card game that there's 3 different things happening on the cards. It seems like it's the right amount of information. And I just really enjoy the challenge, because there is also turns that just aren't very rewarding. I mean, you'll have a turn where you may not have a captain, so you can't do anything with that boat. So you just gotta get a little bit of currency and wait for your next turn. So that's my number five hidden gem from Pinchback and Riddle, Fleet.
All right, cool. My number five is ranked 2,824 on BoardGameGeek, and it is by one of the Brunos. It is Bruno Faiduti, and that is the Dwarf King, published in 2011 by Yellow. And Dwarf King
Yellow
is a trick-taking game, and what I like about it is that the rules of the trick-taking game are changed every round. So one round you may want to collect cards, one round you may not want to get any tricks, another one you may want to only win green cards, and every round that you play there's kind of a wild, weird card that gets thrown in there that has a special ability that somebody's going to get, and it's chaotic, but I love the puzzle. There's nothing, I'm a big euchre player, but there's nothing that I hate more than getting a hand that I know is garbage right from the start. And if you've played euchre enough, you know that's a thing. You can get and you're like, I'm not doing anything this whole round that we're playing.
You can't bluff out of that.
No.
You're really not doing anything, and everybody's going to see it.
When I throw out this nine, act surprised. but the thing I love about Dwarf King is that there are those parameters, and then I get my hands of cards, and it's like, I don't know if this is going to work or not. But I get to try it, and that's what I like. That it's like, I don't know if this is a good hand or not a good hand for whatever the ability is, and we're going to try and make it work. And whether that's how can I lose as fast as possible, how can I win, how can I lose and then win, or win and then immediately stop winning, or all of those type of things. And I just think it's a really cool game that seems like it gets lost in the shuffle. That is the Dwarf King.
Awesome. Great, great choice, Doug. Number four for me is designed by Stefan Bendorf. It's currently ranked 928. So yes, I know, not quite the hidden gem that I was hoping, but I'm shocked we haven't talked about this game yet, Doug, and that's Quix, QWIXX from 2012. Yeah. In Quix, and I know this is one you have in your collection, so if I butcher this, please interrupt. Don't wait until I'm stumbling and rumbling. But you're chucking a ton of dice, and then you're ticking off different combinations in this roll and write. But the caveat is, in order to tick off that number on your sheet, you have to have had the number next to it also marked off. You can't jump
around
on it, right?
No, you can jump.
Okay.
That's the kicker. So when you're rolling and it's your turn, you get, there's two white dice, I believe, and then four different colored dice. And when it's your turn, you can combine the white die with two of the other dice. And if it's not your turn, you only get one of those. But it's your choice to move up as far as you want. Two of the dice colors are ascending. So you start with a two, a three, four, all the way up to 12. And the other one is descending. But it's one of those similar to Welcome To, where if I cross off the seven, I can never go back and do the six, but I can keep going higher. And if the next one I do is a nine, I can't go back and fill in the eight. So there's this kind of race and push your luck of, because every one that you miss, you're losing out on points, but you're doing that kind of struggle of how many points do I want compared to ending the game or kind of locking other players out. So
played that game, however, it was 3 years ago, so I'm glad I had Doug for the assist on that one, but it left a strong enough impression that it's one that, you know, I'd really like to play that again and revisit it. So that's my number four is Quix.
Yeah, that's one I got to pull out with my kids here. They're probably at a really good age for that. My number four, speaking of good games for kids, I wanted to also have kind of a variety here. And 3,332, which seems like a travesty to me, because my family has always loved this game. And that is Tales and Games, The Three Little Pigs, published in 2013, also by Yellow.
A lot of Yellow love.
Lauren Pouchain. And in Three Little Pigs, you are rolling dice Yahtzee style to collect three different house parts, whether you're doing a straw house, a brick house, or a wood house. The amount of dice that you need to spend those or to get those changes, and you're kind of building your houses. And if you roll foxes or wolves, sorry, you get to potentially blow another neighbor's house down with a little spin wheel. And it works really well.
Fairy tales were mean, man.
Yeah, but it works great for teaching kids the Yahtzee mechanism, what we call is like kind of that traditional dice rolling thing. And it's good for parents against kids. There's no real advantage. It seems like I lose this game a lot. It comes with a little storybook in there as well. So lovely components and just a really cool game that my family has enjoyed for a long time. That is Tales and Games, The Three Little Pigs.
That's awesome. Yeah, the next one my family's enjoyed for a long time, number three on my list. It's a Spiel des Jahres winner, currently ranked 1,351. I currently have it rated as a 6 out of 10, which should tell people I don't really want to play it, but I'll play it. But that's a Magic Labyrinth. This is a game where you have a dice underneath the maze, and you've got this little wooden character that's trying to truck your dice throughout this maze. But there's a wall system underneath that will knock out your dice. And the reason why I don't care for the game is because my short-term working memory is nowhere near as good as my children. So yes. I just sit there and get frustrated and get made fun of. All that to say, though, great game. Game that works really well, I'd say, for kiddos age just 4 to 12 in that range. There's a lot of fun there. It's one that we got for Christmas when it first came out for my oldest, and has stayed in our family's collection, even though I've tried to get rid of it a few different times. So I thought, you know, I'll put it on the list and talk about it here. And one that you recently got to play.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, good, good. So that's my number three is The Magic Labyrinth. And again, it was
easy for you to say.
Spiel winner in 2009, folks.
All right. My number three, 3,415. This one kind of shocked me, actually. And that is Walkstar by Fowers Games. Tim Fowers is a designer, published originally in 2010. I know there's a second edition came out, and there's a third edition that came out, and the third edition is ranked even lower. This is a cooperative game on running a Chinese restaurant, and you have to get ingredients, use those ingredients to fill orders. It is a real-time game, which usually I don't like, but it's cooperative, and it is a game that makes me feel like that thematic connection is so good. I've never worked in a Chinese restaurant before. However.
Yet. Growth yet. Mindset.
Yeah. But I do feel like I am part of a kitchen crew where people are yelling, we need more mushrooms. We got to get this. Do we have any of that? Can anybody make this work? Do we have enough, bamboo shoots to fill this recipe? And you go on and you're, all right, we finished that order. You keep going. It's like, we've run out of ingredients. And the fun and frenetic energy of this game, especially when you're playing it with folks that want to get into it to that level.
Yeah.
And just kind of are there to have fun. If you are playing with a stick in the mud, I imagine this is just going to be a disaster of a game. But when I've played it and you kind of really get into it, like, I feel like we're a mom and a pop
That's
Chinese
awesome.
Restaurant. And I can't believe it's...
It's easy to get into? You can get that one going pretty easily?
Yeah, I think All so. Right. I mean, it basically...
I haven't played it yet, though.
Yeah, so no, it's dice rolling, but the ingredients are represented kind of in a big wok that have different numbers on it. It works out really cool. I like it. Walkstar, my number three.
Awesome. Thanks, Doug. Yeah, you know, we often chide, at least I do and Doug does, so that's we, both of us, Board Game Geek, but I think here's a good example. The last one was 1,351 overall, but it was the 19th ranked children's game and the 409th ranked family game. Right. So this next game is 1,014 strategy, but 2,002 overall, which kind of just, you take those stats and it tells you, you know, strategy games are highly regarded on Board Game Geek. And all that to say, rant over. Number two for me is Founding Fathers from 2010. Mm. Make deals and settle arguments in a struggle for a more perfect document. You are working to get the Constitution ratified. And this game designed by Christian Leonard and Jason Matthews. The art is Josh Capel, renowned artist who's done a lot of kids' table board games art. But in Founding Fathers, you are attempting to get the Constitution ratified, and you want to put in the issues that matter the most to you. So you get assigned a character from that era, and you're working to get different pieces through that you want to get through. Game that I've only played once, but I really enjoyed my play. Again, played it over just about 2 years ago, and I enjoyed the back and forth. It is a 3 to 5 player game, so you're always, you know, having to compromise and try to push some things through and make sure that you can get what you want. So that was one that I'm glad that I got to play and would like to revisit at some point as well.
Yeah, me as well. That is one that I'm looking forward to getting to the table again. I'm surprised it's on your list. I didn't know that you liked it that much.
Yeah, it's one that stuck with me, you know, it is a little bit drier. I think you have to have the right group, but it's one that definitely made an impact and one I want to play again.
All right, my number two is ranked 3,705 on the Board Game Geek ranking list. Published in 2012 by Clever Mojo Games. Those that remember Clever Mojo Games would remember that is one of the first Kickstarter companies that kind of had a big splash with Alien Frontiers. And this was their follow-up game that came out, and that is Sunrise City. The designer is Isaias Vallejo, who you may know from the Valeria Card Kingdom series. But Sunrise City is a game with probably the thickest cardboard components I've ever seen in the game, of cardboard kind of giant dominoes of different colors, and you are building this city up over time and scoring points based on how high they are and how big of a connection and things like that that you can make. The components are really cool, especially for the time that it came out. Like I said, I bet you those cardboard tiles are almost a quarter of an inch thick, if you can imagine that. Cardboard that thick, but a really fun, fast city style game that's more of an abstract than kind of anything super thematic, but a really cool game nonetheless. And gosh, it's probably been 8 or 9 years since I've played it, but I would like to get that to the table again.
Awesome. Yeah, it's one I want to play. That's great. And number one for me, this is, like I said, the one game that we did cover, and I had a caveat about it. But that's No Thanks from 2004, designed by Thorsten Gimler and currently published by Amigo in North America. It was episode 132, I believe, where we discussed No Thanks as well as Take Five when we were doing some Amigo card games. And that's not quite accurate either. 144. There it is. So you can hear all about it all the way back. In episode 144, but in No Thanks, you have these little poker chips, and I believe the cards are numbered like 1 through 35 or 1 through 36, and you have to decide if you're going to take that card or not. And Doug, what happens with those poker chips?
Well, if you take them, they are good for you. They are negative points, which you want negative points, so you may put poker chips on a card to not take it, but when you take the card and it has a bunch of them, you take those poker chips.
So there's that balance, and then but you get rewarded for having consecutive sets.
Yeah.
So if you take a card, you might be interrupting a set, but you're offsetting that by getting rid of a ton of negative points if the card's loaded with chips. And there are other times where you really don't want to take a card, but you don't have a chip to put on it, so you have to take the card. Just a fantastic game, very, very small, very, very, very simple game, but definitely one, I believe it's ranked 928 right now, so or 509, sorry, way off, but it is a game that I wanted to talk about. So that's my number one game that I would consider to still be a hidden gem from 2004. 2004 to 2014.
Seems like that could be a Reiner game. Surprised it's, you know. It's
yeah, got, or Wolfgang.
Yeah, some of those elements. Speaking of Reiner Knizia, I have a Dr. Reiner Knizia game as my number one.
No way.
And it's published by Fantasy Flight, which for some of you are thinking, that's impossible. How does that even exist?
Lord
this
of the Rings?
Game is ranked 6,740. And according to Board Game Geek, it has no re-implementation, which I'm shocked by. It's not re-implementing a older game, and it has not been re-implemented yet, but I'd like to see it back. And that is Black Sheep. It was published in 2008, and in Black Sheep, there are three fields laid out in front of you, and you put plastic animals, two plastic animals into every field. And on the bottom of the animals are point values. You are then playing cards from your hand into a field on one side of the field, all the fields that face your side, and then everybody else is doing the same. When every side has three cards from each player, it's essentially a poker hand, which you are using your three cards and the two animals in the middle to make a poker hand. Whoever has the best poker hand takes the two animals and the points that are printed on the bottom of them into their scoring section. There are a couple of black sheep, which are negative points, which you do not necessarily want. But it's got some of those same elements of like Schottentotten of the cards that you're laying down are all animal cards, and they're all the same animals that are part of the plastic animals. And so there's that thing of like, yeah, I've got a really good chance of winning that based on what's out there. But eventually you have to wait for everybody to put their cards there. But they run out of cards to place anywhere else, so they're going to have to put them on that field. And then you kind of score them out, and you keep doing that until all the animals are divvied out. And it's a good little game. It's one that I got when I very first got into the hobby, probably not that much after 2008. But it was actually in Target. It was a game that was sold at Target. Fantasy Flight for a while there had a little bit of a run in Target with kind of family weight games. And this was one of them. And I'm surprised it hasn't been revisited, actually. So that's my number one, Black Sheep. Any honorable mentions for you, Michael?
No, I just brought five. I have a few, but not that I've actually played. I have some that are on my next up shelf.
Sure.
But I thought, if I haven't played them, I shouldn't bring them out of here. So.
Yeah, the only one I have is Medieval Academy, which is 1329 on Board Game Geek, and it's a kind of a cool drafting game where you're moving up different tracks. I think you'd probably really like that one, actually, Michael. We'll have to try and get that to the table sometime.
Cool.
So those are our high five hidden gem games from 2004 to 2014. Let us know on the Discord what you think, what we list or what we missed, or some games that you think people aren't talking about as much from those years. Subscribe to the podcast. You can follow us on X at GameSchoolerU. Join our Discord, gameschooler.com/Discord. I know next week we will be talking about some better ways to teach new games to kids and 30-minute or less family games. And we hope you'll join us then. Thank you so much for spending the last hour or so with us. We truly appreciate it.
Now get out there and keep gaming.